But I guess we can get, even though it's just a few minutes early, there's one thing that, since we're in Koinonia, Koinonia was actually one of the early projects of Holden, and this building was Lodge 5 for the miners, and again, it was used by single miners during the mining days, and also the liquor shop was in the first two rooms. In other words, this building was the same as all the other lodges, so the first two rooms on that side were the liquor store for the mine, and miners could come and order their liquor, and then a few days later it would come up from Chelan, and then they would come here to pick it up. And again, the liquor was allowed in the community, but it was, they had a very strict policy about drunkenness, and if anyone was seen drunk on the streets or in any public areas of the whole area here, they were automatically dismissed from, fired from their jobs and sent down lake. So they were pretty strict about you know, the use of liquor in the community, but you could do it in their homes. But also this, so this building stood unused for a few years, and it was actually in 1963, the first year. It was very cold up at here at Holden that summer, and there was no heat in any of the buildings, and we opened up like Chalet 1 and Chalet 4 and 5 and had fire in the fireplaces where guests could go and just sit by the fireplace to warm up. And it was evident that we needed some place, like we described it, as a hotel lobby, so that people could go to the hotel lobby and sit and visit and warm up around the fireplace. And that fall, or the next fall, there was a group from the American Lutheran Church, or the ELC, I'm not sure when it took place, but it was the youth departments that came to have their annual meeting here. And Willis Shelberg was an architect from Forest City, Iowa, and his wife was on the youth committee board that was meeting, but he came along because he had to babysit their small child, so he was not involved in the meetings. And Carol either knew him or got acquainted with him, and we said, you know, as long as you're an architect, why don't you come down and look at this building and see once what you would suggest that we might do to come up with a hotel lobby. And he was very interested in it, and while he was here, he took a few measurements and you know, sort of studied the area, and also talked to Carol. And Carol was very specific about the fact that he wanted some place where people could have conversations, but where it would be impossible to line up theater-style chairs, because he didn't want a front and a back and just rows of chairs for people to sit in, and, you know, a speaker in one area. So Willis Shelberg went back to his studio, and I think about 3 months later he contacted us and invited me to go back to Forest City and take a look at what he had come up with. And he came up with two basic designs. One would be the fireplace in the center, again, and this would effectively block the room. And and then the other design was, originally this wall wasn't here. They've done a lot of remodeling in this whole area, so that wall wasn't there. There was a rock wall. I guess part of the rock wall is still there. But one of Willis's designs was to have a big rock fireplace at the end of the room. But then he said, if we do that, you know, there's going to be rows of chairs, because everybody will, you know, that'll be the front and everybody will line up. And basically he told us, he says, I'll do the architecture work of design of this building as long as you pick this design. If you pick that design, go to somebody else. And so that's one reason. I mean, I think we still like this design, but that was the other reason that we picked this, is that we had a free architect for that job. But it was designed as a meeting room, and then the hallway again in the back was just like a regular dorm, so there was a hallway down the center, And his design, which was incorporated, was to have a library on one side, which was very important for Mary Hinderly. She was adamant that we eventually have a very good library here and a bookstore. And then on the other side, Rudy Edmond, you know, had been asking for some place for a museum display. And so that was designated for a museum display, although for a couple years, I think it was used as a meeting room, and so he still didn't get his museum for a while. And then finally, he did have a little museum display in that area. And the upstairs of Lodge 5 was sleeping rooms. And part of that was that you probably have heard of Roland Bainton, who was, I think, at Princeton University. He was one of the premier Luther scholars in the world. And Carol had made contact and invited him out here to be on the faculty. And he said that he was going to be in Japan during that, the early part of the summer of that year. And he wanted to have his, I think, his son and their family out. And so he more or less made a deal that if we would have sort of a private housing space for he and his family, that he would come for, I think, 2 or 3 weeks. I don't remember exactly, but so we got busy with finishing, because the rooms up there hadn't been finished yet, and so that we had the instruction from Carol that, you know, that needed to be done by, I don't remember, but let's say August 15th, and so that there was a lot of work put in to finish those rooms up there initially to provide space for Roland Bainton and his family to have a sort of a private space. And now, of course, it's been remodeled, but this wood, all of this cedar wood in here came from Railroad Creek Valley. It was the Swiss loggers were up here at the time, and the loggers cut the trees here, and then what they did was they would take the trees and dump them in the lake, and then a barge would barge them down in a big log boom down to Manson, where there was a mill at that time. It was called Chelan Box Company. And so they would mill the lumber, and then we shipped it back up lake. And so a lot of this lumber in here, I mean, the logs definitely came from here, and all the wood in here, I think, is still what we put in, and that was basically from the valley here that we shipped down to Manson and then brought up as milled lumber. Another interesting thing that happened is that, Mary was very interested in the library, and Carol and Mary had a very good friend in Norway who just happened to own a flooring mill company. And they had gotten acquainted some years earlier when they were in Norway. So Carol contacted his friend and said, you know, we're putting in this library, and it's, you know, this is one of Mary's projects, and would you be willing to give us the parquet, or not the parquet flooring, but the plank flooring? It was laminated from Norway, from his mill. And he said, yeah. He said, just let me know the square footage and I'll send over enough so you have that whole back part of Koinonia. So he gave the lumber, and then he contacted the shipping company that shipped a lot of their lumber to the United States and said, you know, we're contributing this to Holden Village, which of course they didn't know anything about, but will you be willing to ship it on one of your ships to Seattle? And so it ended up in Seattle, no cost to us. And then our insurance agent at the time, he contacted us, and he also worked with shipping lines, and he said, well, you know, you can't get it off of the boat until you pay some duty or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. It was something that was in connection with bringing it into this country. And, you know, we said, well, we're trying to get it to Holden Village free of cost, because so far it hasn't cost us anything. And so his firm, his insurance firm, picked up the bill for paying for the duty to get it into the country after it arrived on ship, and also paid for the shipment over to the dock in Chelan. And then I contacted the owner of the boat company and said, we've gotten this flooring all the way from Norway, and it hasn't cost us anything yet. Would you be willing to ship it up lake at no cost? He said, no, we can't do that. So we had to pay the freight from Chelan to Lucerne, but the rest of it was all free, and it was remained in the floors in there. I don't think it's there anymore. I think when they remodeled, I think that was taken out, and so that Norwegian flooring is no longer here. But it was a nice story of a part of, you know, how Koinonia came about and so forth. The hood was taken down a number of years ago, and I'm not exactly sure, but I think part of it was just the efficiency. It was very inefficient in terms of hot air going up the chimney, and there was no way to, I mean, we had a damper on it, but you know, if you had a fire in the evening, you had to wait for the fire to go out before you could close the damper. So by morning, you were losing a lot of heat. And then also, we did a lot of the recordings for sessions in here. A lot of the sessions were held in here for the faculty. And the people operating the tape library at that time, or the recordings, they didn't like the crackling of the fireplace in the sound recordings. And so I'm not sure how much that ended up, but anyway, they ended up taking it out, and even that hood. I guess one other story was that we had a volunteer electrician up at that time. He was a certified electrician, licensed electrician, and he was up here because of an alcoholic problem, and his family asked us if he could come up here and work. And you know, while he was here, he was dry and fine, and he was a wonderful man, when the hood was supposed to arrive on the barge, and he knew how much it cost. I think it was like $1,500. Teeter Sheetmeller, I remember that in Seattle. They were the ones that built this, and this was, I think, the largest hood they'd ever built. And the only other one that they did was for a fraternity at the University of Washington, wanted the round hood for their fireplace. So anyway, the electrician came up to me on a 4th of July morning and said, you know, Holden is never going to be able to pay for that hood. I mean, we were, you know, pretty strapped for money. And he said, you know, we've got to raise some funds here in the village to pay for that hood because it's coming in on the barge and you're going to get a bill. And I said, well, we've got a rule up here that we don't raise funds here. I mean, Carol was very adamant about that when people are here, they're a captive audience, and you don't want to raise money here. And he just kept after me. He said, well, he went into his wallet, pulled out a $100 bill and gave it to me and said, here's a $100 bill. You find 12 other people here that will donate $100. And so Carol finally agreed to this. And I got up at the noon meal. At that time we had family meals, so, you know, the dining room was full. And I just said, you know, Mr. Olson has given me a $100 bill and we need to raise money for the fireplace. And do we have anybody else who's willing to donate $100? And just in 2 minutes, we had $1,200. And I mean, everybody was so amazed that this could happen. And then I said, well, we need to put carpet in there. do we have any other contributions? And it got up to, I think it was $2,400 just in, you know, 3 minutes, I think we had. And so it became sort of a tradition up here on 4th of July. I think for the next 4 or 5 years, every 4th of July talent show that we had, and those were in the Village Center, that we agreed. I mean, people asked for it. I mean, it was amazing because they were so amazed that, you know, this could happen. And so for the next 4 or 5 years, we had these, we called them auctions. I mean, we didn't auction anything. We just took their money. So the 1 year, we raised enough money for a grand piano, which I don't think is here anymore. I'm not sure. But we brought in a grand piano from Salt Lake City. It was the company brought it up here. And that was $1,200. And we raised $1,200 at the one auction. And then another one was for a sawmill, a portable sawmill, and we raised, I think, $6,000 for the portable sawmill. And then 1 year we raised several thousand dollars for a greenhouse, which we had as part of the landscaping project up here. So over those years, we raised quite a bit of money at the request of the people here. I mean, it was just an interesting dynamic that happened. But that's again, probably no other place but Holden. can you do something like that and have people beg you to have an auction so they can give you money? probably the biggest project that we did at Holden was the hydroelectric plant, and many of you are familiar with maybe the project itself. But when the Holden started, there was no electricity here. The mine had lines running from Manson on the north side of the Lake Chelan, then across the lake at Domke Lake, and up here. And so they had power provided by first Washington Water Power in Spokane, and then the PUD, Chelan County PUD, bought out the power or the upline lines and so forth and provided power here. But when the mine closed down, there was no power. They shut off the switches and actually took the transformers and stuff out of from the upper mine level. The lines remained for many years, and some of the early investigations that Gil Berg started was actually to talk to the PUD and said, well, how much would it take to reactivate those lines so we had power? And I think that they came back with a price like it would be $100,000. They didn't want to do it because we wouldn't be using that much electricity, so it would really be a nuisance to them. They said, you pay $100,000 and you'll have to also maintain the lines, which would be very expensive. I don't remember if any of you were around at that time and came up Lake and saw the line, but some of them were, stuck in the side of the mountain, and it was just a real headache. So obviously they decided that wasn't going to work, and that's why they put in the diesel electric plants first. But almost immediately, they started looking for the possibility of hydroelectric, and Gil Berg put together a committee. It was called the Development Council, and it was a fabulous group of people. At that time, it was all men. I think there was one woman that finally got on the Development Council as an interior decorator, and then there were other women that brought treats to the meetings, but they weren't officially. I don't want to be funny, but I mean that was just the time of society that women weren't too involved in that way. But anyway, this development council that had experts in various fields, electrical field, the plumbing, or the field of transporting water and various other areas, construction projects that a fellow from Kennewick, Washington, by the name of Jezernik, he had run big, huge construction projects all over the world, and he was retired, and so he was on this committee. And they found another family that was on the committee was from Wilbur, Washington, Jerry Sheffields and his father, Lou. And they had big wheat farms over in eastern Washington and also Montana, so they were relatively wealthy. And they knew a lot of eastern Washington, Idaho area, and somehow they discovered these used hydroelectric equipment sitting in a warehouse in Idaho that had been part of an irrigation project. And so they, right on the spot, they purchased them for $1,500 and then turned around and gave them to Holden. So, I mean, that was dirt cheap, but they weren't in the best condition. They had been sitting idle for 20 years. And at that time, I think they were actually manufactured. The units we have here, they were manufactured in the early 1900s. I don't know if it was 1910 or 1912. But, these are units that'll last almost forever if they're maintained. And anyway, the Sheffields then gave us the units and brought them up here at their cost. And then they also gave us the bomb truck, which, you see, in fact, it just went past the window a little bit ago. And that was a military army or a military surplus. And I think it was an ammunition truck, but we called it the bomb truck. And it was the only winch we had, but it gave us some capability of, picking up heavier equipment. And then luckily, nobody knew really I mean, we didn't have an engineer that could engineer the project. And we're, one of the things with the boat company, now it's not so much now as it used to be back then. The Old Lady of the Lake was an old wooden boat that would handle, I think, 125 people, you know, much smaller than the current Lady Two. And so part of the communications on the lake was conversations you would have on the boat. And I mean, it was sort of like, you know, 2 hours of gossip going up and down the lake. And you know, some people associated with the Development Council in Holden would say, you know, we're looking for somebody to help us put in a hydroelectric system up here. Well, Henry Schwecke had been with Seattle Light for many years and was retired, semi-retired. He had a place right across the lake at Knutrick. His family had owned that property. I think it was 160 acres, and they had started to develop a little orchard that, you know, didn't, you know, work out. But they had a cabin over there, and he and his wife would use that as their private retreat, and he was going to put a hydroelectric plant over there. He was a good engineer and a good machinist. He had a little machine shop in his own place in Wenatchee. He had also, at the same time, the PUD, the Chelan County PUD, was going to put in a new plant in Stehekin. And so he was interested in that, and he put in a proposal to them and put in basically a bid to do that work up there, and they turned him down because he was a single individual. He didn't have a business license, a contractor's license, and so that it's understandable that they turned him down. So he was upset about that and sorry. I mean, he was a very low-key person, so there wasn't much difference in his facial expression when he was happy and sad, but he was definitely sad about that. Well, then he heard on by the grapevine on the boat that we were looking for somebody, and so he contacted Gil Berg and the Development Council, and they hired him. And so he really was the person who you know, put together the hydro plant for Holden Village, and then he used our volunteers to do that. And part of the deal was that since he was working on his own hydro plant across the lake, that we would take some of our volunteers a couple days a week and over there and help him carry concrete pipe to make his water line from the creek to where his power plant was. So we exchanged a lot of labor, basically. And so we ended up not paying him very much for all the work that he did. It was a several year process. And I mean, it was a very primitive process. Like, I don't know if you've gone up there and seen the concrete that's poured for the base of this. I mean, it's a huge amount of concrete. And we didn't have that cement mixer that they do now. We had a half sack, small electric. We had an electric cord from a plug in the power pole to run this half sack mixer, and we had to hand screen all the gravel and for the project, and we carried, you know, we just went around wherever we could find some gravel. There was a sort of a gravel pit on the creek up here, and we brought it down from there or wherever we could find it. So it was, people were working basically day and night to pour this concrete for this base for these two huge hydro units, and it, you know, it got done. They got them there. Henry had to redo some of the wiring because rats had gotten into some of the wiring when it was sitting in the warehouse for 20 years. And there were also some parts off of the governor that were no longer there, and he machined them himself in his little basement machine shop. And so it was, and the initial process was that the hydro plant would run from the lower diversion dam, which I don't even know if the lower diversion dam is that, Wayne, is that still up there?
It's there, but it's not functional
anymore. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that was the original water line for the for Holden's and for the mill, for the water, for the potable water as well as for the mill. And it was all in wood stave pipe, you know, cedar pipe, basically. And it was marvelous stuff because if it sprang a leak, you would just go down and get a cedar shake, pound it in the hole, and it would expand and seal up the hole. So, I mean, they lasted for a long time, and I don't think they're being used now. But anyway, that was the original water line for both the village and for the hydro plant, and that only had a head of, I think it was 900 feet. So these units were designed for closer to, I think it was 560 feet or something like that. So we were just getting, half or less of the power, but it was at least free power once we got it going. And in August of 1964 was when the power was first turned on, and it was a big day for Henry Schwecke because he pulled the switch and it worked immediately, and he let the PUD know, because the one in, I forgot to tell you, the one in Stehekin, they pulled the switch and it didn't work. Something happened, but he was delighted. I mean, he's not a sore loser, but he was delighted that this worked and that one didn't. And then almost immediately we started plans for extending the pipeline further up the mountain, building new diversion dam and collection box. And it took another couple of years. And the Swiss loggers, they were loggers in the valley for about 10 years, and they were from Switzerland. That's why we call them Swiss loggers. But they used the highline process. They didn't build roads in the valley, but they strung cables up the side of the mountains and would bring the logs down. They had a diesel engine up that they actually pulled up to the top, and then they would lower the logs down and break them with the engine and so forth. And anyway, they had a Caterpillar, a D2 Caterpillar, which wasn't a real big one, but it was bigger than we had. We didn't have any. And so that they volunteered to build the new road up. I mean, they liked us here because we were the only ones in the valley, and we had a snack bar. And so the snack bar has been very, very important to a lot of people. And anyway, they then built the road and helped us put that in. But those pipes, they're 14-inch steel-wrapped pipes with what they call dresser couplings that tie them together. And they were, 50 foot long? I can't remember.
Yeah, right? I think they're 50 foot.
Yeah, 50 foot long, and they weighed 1,000 pounds apiece. And we took one at a time up the mountain with this bomb truck, and just very slowly up the mountain and lowered them into place, and then with some come-alongs, worked them into the dresser couplings and tightened them up. And so that whole pipeline, I think it was about 2,000 feet of pipeline that went from where the new pipeline started at 900 feet up to the new diversion dam. We had a cement mixer up there, and we had it up above, and again, the Jeep, which is no longer around, in the back of this little Jeep, we hauled aggregate up there, and I even made multiple trips with the four-wheel drive going up this mountain road to haul gravel and so forth up there. So, I mean, the whole thing was very primitive, but it worked. And I mentioned to Wayne the other day that I gave a program in Seattle to a group that was learning more about Holden, and I had some pictures of the hydro plant and the work, and this contractor came up to me afterwards and he said, "Yeah, that's impossible, you couldn't have done that." And I said, "Well, we didn't know it was impossible, so we did it." But so many people were involved in the work of that, and Henry Schwecke was basically the savior that allowed that project to go forward. And so since August of 1964, Holden has been using hydroelectric for its power source, and very inexpensively. Of course, a lot of money has been put into the system to update it, and new wheels have been put on and so forth, so it's not completely free, but it's very inexpensive. So it's been a great project, one of the other projects was a Lucerne dock that you came in on. Now that dock, I don't remember the exact dates when it was. It was in the, I think, the mid-70s when that dock was put in. In 1969, for some reason, the Swiss loggers were still up here, and the Forest Service wanted the old House Sound dock removed. And they really didn't tell us about it, but we owned the old House Sound dock because it went along with this gift of the village. And we leased it back to the loggers, I think for $1,000, or maybe it was for nothing, but with the understanding that when they were done with it, we would get it back. And also there was a, what they called a dock house down there. The fellow who ran the crane on the dock during the mining days lived in a little dock house, which was a beautiful little, sort of like a schlay, but not as nice as the schlays and not as big. And that was right across from where the public toilets are down there. And the Swiss loggers were going to give us that house at the time that they left the valley. Well, in 1969, the Forest Service, and I, part of this I'm just guessing because I never was able to get the true story, but I think what happened is that the Swiss loggers were within 2 months of finishing their contract for logging up here. They didn't want to bring their equipment back the next year because of the expense of taking up lake. So they worked out a deal with the Forest Service, or the Forest Service worked out a deal with them that the Forest Service wouldn't hold them to the contract if they would burn down the dock and the dock house before they left, which theoretically belonged to Holton Village. At the time it belonged to them, but it was supposed to come back to us. So that fall, the dock was burned down, the little house was burned down, and Holton was left without any means of getting people in and out of here. And it was, I mean, the Forest Service later admitted that it was a mistake. But it was a mistake that happened, and we had to deal with it. And the next spring, I went down to Cove Marina, which is right down on the lake down here, and they had two of the old house on barges that they had just tied up, and I guess they bought them from the mine company, and they just had them tied up down there. And I said, can we, you know, rent or lease one or both of these barges, and we would bring it up and tie it to the shore, and then use that as a dock. And I don't recall exactly what happened, but it didn't work out. If the Forest Service wouldn't approve it, or if Cove Marina decided not to do it. But for then 2 years, there was a little dock in front of what's now the boat company property. It used to belong to Oscar Getty. And there was just a very small dock there that was very inadequate, but that was the only thing for the boat to come in on. So for 2 years, both winter and summer, of course, it didn't go up and down with the water, so in the summer, it was okay to get off. It was a little bit inconvenient, but it worked. But in wintertime, the boat had to just pull up on the rocks. And so everybody that came to Holton during that time, in the wintertime, had to go down the gangplank over the rocks, and even all the stuff that we brought in, milk and all the produce and freight and everything, we had to carry over the rocks for 2 winters, and it was doable, but it didn't work very well. The first winter that this happened, there was a youth group from Port Angeles that Dr. Kittner, who was a physician in Port Angeles, and he was bringing up this group of youth for Christmas, and he chartered a boat on his own to bring the youth up here, and the only place for them to dock was Refrigerator Harbor. And so that they got off there, and he was really upset. I mean, he got up here and he said, you know, how can you run a place like that? You can't even get people off the boats. And we said, well, this is the situation. We don't want to make the Forest Service mad, so we're just trying to live with it and do the best we can. And he said, well, do you mind if I write some letters and make some inquiries to see if I can get anything going? And we said, you as an individual can do anything you want. You're not officially associated with Holton Village. And it so happens that his partner in the medical firm, or the medical office that he was in Port Angeles, was the campaign chairman for, I think it was either Magnuson or Jackson in those years. You know, they were powerful senators in the state of Washington. So he wrote a letter on his letterhead to, I think it was Magnuson, and just said that we've got this situation and this retreat center is just getting going. It's isolated. The Forest Service made a mistake. You know, what can we do? And of course, he heard back from Magnuson right away, and things sounded like it was getting going. And then it turned out that, you know, that was the Nixon era. And that year, because of budget limitations, they had declared that the Forest Service budget for all projects would be, you know, reduced by 50%. And so that eliminated the possibility of this. So that didn't happen. But since Dr. Kittner started this process, then, you know, he talked to us and we talked to him, and we came up with this idea that we would start a letter-writing campaign. And I went through the whole list of people on our mailing list, and anybody that had a title, you know, like a medical doctor, an attorney, a professor, anybody that had some title, I wrote a letter to and said, this is the situation. We need you to write to your senator and tell him that, you know, we need something done up here because we're basically isolated. You know, so we started getting all these letters back from Washington, D.C. They were carbon copies of letters that were written to the writer, but from all of these people all across the United States, and probably, I don't remember, I think it was out of the, you know, 50 states, we probably had letters from, 35 or 40 states. And it looked like things were really starting to happen, and I went down to the Forest Service and told them what we were doing, and they were all for us. And the ranger at that time said, you know, don't tell anybody because this would really be, wouldn't be kosher to do this, but I'll have our secretaries help write those letters to these various people. And so I took down, you know, copies and the list of addresses, and they actually helped in the district office to write letters to various people on our mailing list to get more letters into Washington. And we had Washington, and I think Larry has the copy. I saved all these letters, and in the museum someplace in the boxes is a document of all these letters from, you know, all these senators and Secretary of Agriculture and anyway, that really got things going. And one winter morning, we used Koinonia for our winter at that time, and out here we had tables that we used for meals, that, you know, folding tables. We were having breakfast one Saturday morning, and we heard an airplane fly over fairly low over here, which was unusual. I mean, it was winter, we had, you know, 8 feet of snow on the ground, and this plane's kept flying over, so we naturally went outside, and it was Ernie Gibson, the pilot, the seaplane pilot, and when he saw we were out there, he flew over, made one pass, and dropped something out of his window, and of course, we retrieved it, fortunately. It had a long, you know, red flag on it. We retrieved it, and it was a message that I should come down to Lucerne immediately that morning to meet with the boat company in the Forest Service, and this was like in, I don't know, I think it was March. So I took the snowmobile and went down to meet with the Forest Service and the boat company. And the Forest Service said, we got word from Washington that we have to start on this process, or on this dock immediately. They want us to have it in by the end of the summer, and we're in a real time crunch because the lake would be starting to come up. And part of the dock, the pilings, the original pilings and the bulkhead against the shore, had to be put in before the lake came up. So that's why there was so much rush to get it going. And then the district ranger contacted me, and he said, we're in trouble now because we've promised we're gonna do this, but we don't have time to put any of this out for bid. And by law, we're required to put out, you know, to buy the pilings and the special bolts and so forth to tie this whole thing together for the initial work. He said, there's no way because it's a, you know, 3 or 4 month process. And I said, well, you know, we're not under those obligations. Why don't we order them? And so Holden Village, actually, I went down there and he gave me the specification sheets because the government, you know, has very definite specification sheets for everything. And he gave me a list of these, and I called Seattle, they told me which outfit to call, and I said, you know, we need this in 4 weeks. Can you get it to us? They said, yeah, we'll get it to you. And Oscar Getty, who was one of the old pioneers down here that still, or he's dead now, but he owned 3 acres of land, and that's where the boat club is. And he was always mad at the Forest Service because the Forest Service always wanted to take over his 3 acres and he didn't want to give it up, which he never has. Even the family has never given it up. And so he came over to me and he gave me a check for I think it was $3,000 or $3,500. He was relatively well off, even though he wore rags. And he gave me this check. He said, don't tell the Forest Service I'm doing this, but I want to help Holden with this dock project. And I don't want the Forest Service to know it. So that was the $3,500 we used for this initial ordering of some of the material that needed to get up the lake right away. Well, then the process got going and that work was done. The boat company, it was really a joint project between the Forest Service, the boat company, and Holden Village. And the boat company did all the pile driving and they got the bulkhead put in. And then during the summer, we happened to have a man up here on the volunteer staff who had supervised big construction crews, and he volunteered to be the sort of the volunteer person to work with the other volunteers, and we helped then. We did a lot of the work on actually constructing the dock down there. So it was again an unusual project that, but it was a cooperative project, and it was one that I think, you know, it proved again over and over that, you know, the Forest Service and the Holden Village has had good working relations for many years. Initially, when we got up here, this was told to me several years afterwards, but they had a bet going down in the Chelan Ranger's office, and they said, you know, what's the longest you think Holden Village will last before they pull out? And I was told that the longest bet was 3 years. If they thought Holden would last 3 years before they pulled out. And of course, after that, they were sort of laughing at it themselves that, you know, that we've lasted that far. But they started trusting Holden when they found out that we were interested in basically the same conservation and multiple use as the Forest Service. And they basically allowed us, I mean, the first couple of years, they didn't pay any attention to us because they didn't think we were going to last. Then after 3 years, they started paying more attention to us, but they trusted us, and they allowed us to do things. In fact, you know, I tried my best to, if we had a project, I would send a letter down and say, this is what we'd like to do, can we get permission? And one time, Bill Rhines was the forest ranger down there at that time, and one time when he was up here, he pulled me aside and he said, please don't request permission for all these little projects, because he said, if you do that and you put it in writing, then I've got to go through the whole process of you know, making a decision and writing to the supervisor in Wenatchee, and he said it would just be easier. And he says, I trust you to, you know, these little projects, just go ahead and do. And if it's a major project, you know, contact me and then we'll decide if you need to put in an application. So, you know, for those years, it was a wonderful relationship we had with them, and they knew that we were trying to do the right thing, and we trusted them to, you know, be very helpful to us and so forth. So the dock project down there was just one of those that proved that. And of course, now in recent, with the rehabilitation project up here, the mining company, or the Rio Tinto, has done some more improvements down there that to the dock. So sort of the time goes on with the jacuzzi is another project that, in fact, I was talking with the carpenter. I forgot his name already.
Noah.
Okay, I can't hear.
Noah.
Oh yeah, no. Yeah, and he was asking. I mean, he didn't realize that I'd been up here, and he was explaining to me about the project, and I'd say, yeah, I'm sort of familiar with the jacuzzi project. And then I told him that he was saying how they designed it and so forth, and I told him, well, the way we designed the first one was that, first of all, Carol Hinderly and I were at a meeting in Seattle, and we stayed in, I think, what they called the Royal Inn. Now it's, I think it's still there, but it's called the Loyal Inn.
The Loyal Inn.
Yeah. And Carol, I mean, and this was in the late 60s, and, you know, there weren't really a lot of jacuzzis around anymore. They were just starting to become, you know, or used by a lot of people. And Carol loved it, and he said, we've got to have a jacuzzi here. And so the next time I went to Seattle, I stayed at the Royal Inn again, and I went and sat in the jacuzzi and measured on my body, you know, how high the seats were and how deep it was. And I took measurements and then brought that back. And I went over to, in Wenatchee, to, I looked up and there was a jacuzzi dealer there. But it wasn't for jacuzzi hot tubs, it was for jacuzzi pumps and so forth. At that time, in the late 60s, jacuzzi didn't have a standalone jacuzzi, I mean a therapy pool. The only thing they would sell would be the pumps and the pumps and the nozzles and then the heater, and then you were on your own. And I said, well, don't you have a design or something? And they said, no, we don't have any design. You know, you buy the pumps, the nozzles, and the heater, and the plumbing, and you design it. So that's when I went to back to Seattle and got the measurements, and we did the work here and put it in. And at that time, again, you know, there was nothing in the budget. You know, whether the board liked it or not, some of these projects, if we could raise money, we didn't wait for the next budget cycle. We figured that if we could raise the money to do it, then we would go ahead and do it. So that's how the jacuzzi got started. So it was in the late 60s, and Fern Olson, who was one of our great volunteers from Spokane, Washington, she knew the manager of a large, I think it was a penny store in Spokane, and they belonged to the same church, and she approached them and said, you know, we want to put this jacuzzi in, and we need about $2,500, and he donated this money for the jacuzzi. And so we were able to buy this equipment, and I assumed that, I don't recall, but I assumed that maybe it cost us another couple thousand dollars to, before we got it in. But we did all the concrete work and the plumbing and you know, and pretty soon we have our jacuzzi for, you know, very little. And it lasted until last year. So it's lasted a long time, and we even had it plumbed into the oil burners or oil hot water heaters in Lodge 3, because that lodge wasn't being used during the winter, and we didn't have enough electricity. But we decided we wanted to have the jacuzzi in the winter, so we plumbed it into those boilers, and so we had the jacuzzi running. And the 1 year we had it running was the time that we had, I think, the coldest on record up here. It got down to minus 32 degrees. And the jacuzzi was running, so as the temperature kept getting lower and lower, more and more of the people in the village wanted to go and take a jacuzzi so they could say they had taken a jacuzzi at, you know, this temperature. I got in there at minus 29, but I didn't make minus 32. But we have pictures of people walking up the hill and, you know, wrapped up in bathrobes and towels around them and hiking boots and getting into the jacuzzi at these low temperatures. But so the jacuzzi has a long history of a wonderful memories, I think, for a lot of people, and it's great to see it. It looks beautiful, and it should be back in operation, it sounds like, pretty soon. So, but that's just, you know, another one of the projects that happened up here. The Science and Technology Committee started many years ago, actually because of a fellow named Dr. Matheson, he now lives over in San Juan Islands. Lola, do you know him, or do you know if he's still living? I haven't had any contact with him. And
I heard you say the name earlier, but it's not.
Yeah,
here.
But he was up here visiting and loved the place. And I remember walking down there, and we had just built the river sauna, or we were getting ready to build it, and was trying to figure out, you know, I thought, well, it would be neat to take excess heat from the sauna and then heat the dressing room. And, you know, I just casually asked him, you know, is there any way that this can be done efficiently? And he said, well, he said, we're working at something. He was the director of the Donald Douglas Research Labs down at the Hanford Reservations at the time. And he said, we're working on an interesting heat transfer tube it's a vacuum tube, and it'll efficiently transfer heat from one location to the other. And he said, you know, that might work, and I don't know if we can get anything like that for you, but he said it's worth thinking. And then I asked him, or he made the statement, he said, I wish I could come up here and volunteer my time, but I don't have that luxury. I can come up here for a week as a guest. And, you know, then I said, well, I mean, are you willing to, if I write to you, will you give us advice once in a while? And he said, yeah, we ought to put together, you know, a group of people. And he knew Leo Bustead, because Leo was also down there, and Rudy Edmund, of course. And so the Science and Technology Committee got started with a very small number of very talented people. And it's still in operation today and contributing to the village in many ways in terms of some of the technology projects and so forth. But when the tailings, you know, we were always sort of fighting the dust of the tailings. And one time that Leo Bustead said, well, I've got a friend who is the director of the labs. I think they're in L.A. or is it Lovelace? I can't remember right offhand. It's in the book, by the way, if you haven't been able to read the book. I wrote a book, and some of this information is in there, and it's available through Amazon, either Kindle or paperback. So, but I can't remember the labs. Anyway, he was the director of the lab, and Leo said, I'll send him some tailings, a little package of tailings, and we'll see what he says in terms of how dangerous they are for asthma or breathing, because Mary Hinderly had asthma, and she suffered with asthma, and it was always worse up here, even though most of the dust was down. We did get some in the village. Anyway, he sent the package, and we got a letter back from the lab and said, you know, you really don't have to worry about it as a danger, because the particles size of the tailings is too big for it to really irritate the lungs. But he said, it's not good for you, but it's not dangerous. So, you know, we sort of took that as, I mean, there was nothing we could do it anyway, but at least we didn't have to feel guilty about having people up here with the tailings blowing on occasion. But these are some of the things that the Science and Technology Committee did. Another one, and some of you have probably heard about the Pigeon Project, and I've heard a lot of stories about, you know, why we did that. The only reason we did it was that Leo Bustead was always interested in getting people. He was the director of the School of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University. And his purpose in life, in a sense, was to get people and pets together. In fact, he started an organization called People-Pet Partnership.
Delta Society.
Pardon?
Wasn't it Delta Society?
Well, the Delta Society, I think, was another one. There was a couple of different organizations. But he said that he had thought of homing pigeons as a possibility for retirement homes, because he said that, you know, people that are retired and living in retirement homes need something to do. They need pets, and it's not always convenient to have, you know, a cat or a dog, and some of them don't even allow pets in the retirement homes. Now they do, because of Leo Bustead. He actually got a law passed, and he went back to Washington, D.C. for the signing of the law that allowed pets to be brought into hospitals and to retirement homes and so forth. But anyway, he had this idea that homing pigeons would be used to send little messages between retirement homes. And so he said, do you know anything about pigeons? And I said, absolutely nothing. He said, well, I've got a friend. He always had a friend that was raising homing pigeons. And he said, I'll bring a few up here. And there was a discussion, well, do they have to be born at the site where they return to? You know, and the guy who was providing the pigeons says, no, if they were young and they were raised at a site. And the first pigeon coop we had was the Chalet 1 garage down here. And we built little pens in the garage down here, and we had pigeons there. And when they grew up, then, you know, I mean, we had these people that had raised them to give us help to carry it on here. And then we built a coop, and I don't know if it's still there. It was an A-frame. Is it up there?
It's still there, yeah.
Yeah. And that was specifically built because we had problems here with some of the weasels getting in, and they love pigeons, and they would clean out a pigeon pen, you know, very quickly. And so we thought we had got better on the weasels, and we built this A-frame here that was very, very safe. And we raised pigeons for a couple of years, and it was really interesting, because when we opened up the cages for them to do their flying exercises, you always let them out. And we always did it about coffee break time when everybody was gathered up here. And, you know, we had 10 or 12 pigeons, and they would take out of their coops, And they would always make three big circles. They would always fly together as like a big family. They would always make three big loops and then they would head out. And that was always their, for some reason, I guess they think in threes or whatever, but so we did that for a number of years, and then we started taking them down to 7 Mile and letting them loose, and they would get back here very quickly. And then down to Lucerne, and they were back here very quickly. And then I had a boat on the lake, so whenever I went down, I would take two pigeons in a little pen, and the first time let them loose at 25 Mile Creek. And I marked down the time that I let them loose, and then when I got back later in the afternoon, I checked with the person up here who was sort of watching, and I was worried the first time because they left their coop, they did their three circles, and they head out over 25 Mile Creek, not down the lake, but over the mountains. And they were back here in like 30 minutes from 25 Mile Creek to, but they didn't go down the lake and then up the valley, they went over the mountains. We did that for a number of years, or a number of times, just because it was fun to do, and so we were helping Leo see if this was a viable project or not. And then one Christmas, in fact, Howard Gilling and his family were up here many Christmas, and Howard came running in one time and he said, "I think you lost your pigeons." And every single pigeon was dead, and a weasel had gotten in. And and then we just gave up with the project because the weasels were smarter than we were, so there was no use in carrying on the project. But it was, again, for a couple of years, it was a very interesting project. And these were some of the things that the science committee did. Composting. We started the first composting up here way back. In fact, it was started by a campus pastor from University of Minnesota, Duluth. He and his wife were really into ecology and so forth, and they came up here for a sabbatical and asked me about starting a composting thing, and I said, "I don't think we're going to get into that. That's not something that we're interested in." And they said, "Well, can we do it ourselves?" And so we gave them two barrels, and I said, "Well, if you want horse manure, you can get it down here to get it started." And so they were living in Chalet too, and so they set up two barrels and started their own composting just because they felt we should do it. And it wasn't too long after that that a fellow by the name of Wold, I can't think of his first name right anyway, he was a horticulturist that had been working with the pineapple plantations in Hawaii, and he was big into composting, and he had actually come up with a new composting system. He called it the sliding air tube composting system, and he had won an award from Rodell. Some of you probably remember Rodell. I think they're maybe still a publishing company, but they had a prize each year, a national prize for someone who had done something for gardening and so forth. And he had won this national prize. And so, he said, "Well, can I set up this sliding air tube system up here and see once how it works?" So he did that. And for many years, that's how Holden composted their organic waste up here. Now I think they have some more sophisticated composting machines. But we got started in it. And of course, after Wold started this system, then I was all for it. And thought, "Wow, this is a great system." And then we also had solar hot water, which was another project that really some of the volunteers asked if we could do. At that point, some of you remember the whole Mother Earth News or Whole Earth catalog. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the Bible for the early hippie ecologists. And, we saw an article in there, or plans in there for solar hot water. And so we got the copper tube and we made the panels out of plywood and put, transparent film over the top of them. We made 12 of them. We put them on top of the hospital, which is now Agape. And we got the valves and the pumps and so forth, which was minimal cost. And we set this up, and we had solar hot water for 3 or 4 years, from mid-May till about mid-September. And then after that, there's too many clouds. But during that time, we provided all the hot water for the laundry during that period of time. And it was a wonderful, we didn't do it because it was necessarily economical, but it was a great educational opportunity to, because at that time, and this was in the, you know, the early 70s, and not many people were doing solar. I mean, we talked about it, but there wasn't many projects going at that time. And so it was a marvelous thing for people to actually see, because we had it set up, you know, in the laundry with temperature gauges on it and so forth, so if the people were interested, they could go up there and see what the incoming water temperature and what the final temperature was, and, you know, how we had it set up. And it was very crude, but it worked great, you know, and it was wonderful for a lot of people to get acquainted with solar energy. We also did projects with vermiculture or vermicomposting, where you use garbage worms or earthworms for composting, and that didn't really work up here because of the cold winters, and we would have had to heat the worms because they don't eat much after when they freeze. Although they do lay eggs. That's one marvelous thing of the worms. They, if they get too cold, they'll lay eggs and die. And then in the spring when it warms up, you have all these new worms. So it's a sort of a perpetuating system, but during the time they're dead, they don't eat anything. So we didn't, yeah. Oh, time to go, okay. Oh yeah, we go, all right, so I guess thank you very much, and tomorrow morning will be the final session that I'll be giving at 11 o'clock, and so look forward to seeing some of you then. Thank you.